Blog Talk Radio.
Washington Speaks. Normally on Booker T. Washington Speaks on Saturday evening at this time, we have our African American Family Forum program. But tonight we won't have that program, but we will have a pre-recorded program. And before we play the pre-recorded program, we do want to thank all of you who are listening. We hope that you've had, so far, a very blessed and safe holiday season, and we wish you much prosperity, success, and happiness in the coming year. So at this time, we are going to play a commercial. We see that we do have people coming on, so we may have some discussion. But we actually had planned to have a pre-recorded show, but since we do see that we do have guests coming on, we may change that plan, and depending on how many guests we have that come on and actually have some conversation. But we do want to, at this time, go ahead and give a commercial for our book, which is, as some of you may be familiar, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. I want to tell you a little bit about the history of this book. As some of you may already know, I am the direct descendant, one of the direct descendants, in fact, the senior great-grandson of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, who founded Tuskegee Institute in Alabama in 1881 and presided as the president of Tuskegee until his untimely death in 1915. For 34 years, through his leadership at Tuskegee, he was actually very successful in raising the consciousness of African-American people throughout the country, as well as people in European colonized societies throughout the world. And at Tuskegee, he was very, very, very active in promoting the idea of self-help. And so in 2015, I decided to write a book to explain to many people who either did not understand the work of Booker T. Washington because of miseducation or misinformation, or to acquaint our younger generation about Booker T. Washington, as well as other great leaders of the African American people. It's unfortunate that we have so many young people today in school, and those even who have graduated, who don't understand the importance of the people that have gone ahead of us and what they have done to try to secure a better place for our people, the African-American people in America. And so we felt it necessary, since I am a professional writer, I've been formally trained in college to be a professional writer. And so I felt that it was necessary to use my skills to help to change the landscape, you might say, concerning our black leaders. And so I went ahead and I did much research over a period of several months to find significant writers that contributed to the legacy of the African-American people rising up from slavery, and I extracted some of the most significant parts of their writing, going all the way back to David C. Walker, a very significant piece that he wrote around 1833, somewhere around 1833, called David Walker's Appeal. And then coming up even further to Frederick Douglass, and of course, he wrote several books. One of them is My Freedom and My Bondage. Another is the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. And he was a prominent abolitionist speaker prior to the Civil War and continued to work on behalf of the cause of true black freedom after the war. And then we had Booker T. Washington, and I wrote extensively from his writings because he is the title personality for the book, and also I'm more familiar with him because I grew up right there in his sunshine, so to speak, at Tuskegee, and went to school there, as a matter of fact, visited his home numerous times, and walked on the grounds that he actually had laid out for the campus, and went to classes and also other activities in buildings which he actually had the students to build. So he's the prominent person, but I also went on and discussed the teaching of W.E.B. Du Bois, who some people say was Booker T. Washington's nemesis. I don't really look at it like that, although they did have some very diametrically opposing views, as is bound to happen in any type of upward social movement, because everyone doesn't see the problem from the same perspective and certainly don't always agree on the solutions. But I think that was healthy for our people, that we did have this particular, I won't call it conflict, but this particular difference of opinions. And so we included W.E.B. Du Bois's writing in our book, and we continued further to Marcus Garvey, a very, very significant person that we should all learn about, and sadly most Americans, black Americans, even those with graduate college degrees, don't really understand the importance of Marcus Garvey in our history. And then, of course, we came up forward in history, and we talked about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and many of you may not know this, but he was so significant in terms of the upliftment of the African-American people that Gerald Ford, the President of the United States, sent a personal envoy to his funeral to recognize from the office of the President the great work of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And then, of course, we had around the same time, although the Honorable Elijah Muhammad outlived him by years, we had Martin Luther King, who I personally knew and considered to be one of my personal friends. We weren't buddy-buddy friends where we hung out together. One reason was because he belonged to a different college fraternity than I did, and so I didn't have the opportunity to see him in that particular kind of setting, and we didn't live in the same town for most of his career, but during the time that we were co-located in Atlanta, I did have the chance to have lunch with him and also to attend church and to hear him speak. In fact, at the last time that he spoke in a church in his hometown of Atlanta, I was there, and I met him actually when we were together for a program in Tuskegee when he was about 27 years old and I was 12 years old. My father introduced me to him because they knew each other very well. They both were graduates of Morehouse College. And so anyway, I went ahead and included him, and then I included some very brief statement by Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, two of the revolutionary speakers of that time, the 60s. And then, of course, coming up into the more present time, Wallace Muhammad. So this is the background of the book. And I see that we do have some people that want to be heard, I suppose. And even though we had really planned that this wasn't going to be a talk show, because, frankly, this evening I had earlier today some issues that made me feel that it would not be comfortable for me physically to do the show, but I'm not going to deny you all the opportunity to talk. The fact of the matter is, though, that I did not choose a topic, but I do want to talk about something now that I see people here that like to come on the show and be heard. The thing I want to talk about, you just heard me mention the names of some of our leaders in the past. So what I would like to do, since I don't want to just have the monologue that I would have had if you hadn't come on, is let's see if we can't compare the leadership of or messages of Booker T. Washington and Elijah Muhammad and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King's birthday is coming up next month, and so I think it would be appropriate that we recall his great work, his message, and also I think it's very important that we don't forget Elijah Muhammad. Many people don't really know much about him. It's been over 40 years since he left us, but he was the one that actually was responsible for the Black is Beautiful movement that occurred in the 60s and 70s, and it's coming back, actually. You see young people today, I see it on the campus where I teach here in Georgia, beginning to wear the Afro styles again, and the dashiki style hasn't come back, but I believe you'll probably see, as time goes by, a reassertion of Black beauty in the clothing styles, because one of the things that has been happening here recently is that African-American women have started taking a stand and standing up in a very, very wonderful way. Down in Alabama, just a few weeks ago, a racist child molester by the name of Judge Roy Moore, who seemed like he was going to sail into the U.S. Senate just on the basis of the fact that Alabama traditionally has been what they call a red state. Red in Alabama basically meant, as far as I'm concerned, old-school racism, and it looked like he was headed for the Senate to represent Alabama in the Senate with his racist attitudes, and yet he was defeated by a person whose fame was achieved when he prosecuted the surviving two people that bombed the church in Birmingham, the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in 1963, which resulted in the killing of four little girls. I happen to know the family of one of those little girls myself. And in fact, ironically, it was my own uncle, great uncle, that was one of the co-founders of that church. So I feel a particular attachment to what has happened. And so I was so happy that Doug Jones, who prosecuted those two people and found them guilty of murder, of homicide, I don't know if it was first-degree murder, because it was a civil rights charge, I think, but in fact, they were found guilty of killing those girls. And so the Black women, and they made all the difference. They after they got off work in the evenings on that Tuesday, I think it was, they crowded the polls and defeated, almost single-handedly, those Black women in Alabama defeated Roy Moore. And so I think that we're going to see a resurgence of this Black Pride movement, Black is Beautiful movement, and we're going to ask you all to speak about that. But the topic, since I decided we'll go ahead and we'll have a conversation, is let's compare the programs and messages, the works of starting with Booker T. Washington. If you want, you can start on the other end with Martin Luther King and then Elijah Muhammad and of course, we have Booker T. Washington to begin with, and then Elijah Muhammad and Martin Luther King. Okay, and I see our friend, dear friend, hey, we've never met personally, but I definitely consider him a friend. Mr. Bianchi has arrived. And since you just came on, Mr. Bianchi, I just want to make a statement. I had really intended tonight to not do the show as we normally do. I had a health issue today, and I didn't feel I'd be up to actually managing the forum, and I was going to play a pre-recorded program. But I'm feeling much better now. In fact, I feel much, much better, so we're going to go ahead. But the topic that I decided to do is let's compare the leadership, the work, the messages of Booker T. Washington and Elijah Muhammad and Martin Luther King and see what we have to say about that. So as we always have, first come, first serve. And so let me just get everybody's mic turned on here. And I'm going to ask y'all, if you're not actually talking, could you put your mic on mute so we won't have to hear any background noise that may be in your vicinity? All right, thank you. Let me turn the mics on. You just have to bear with me. I'm working with a different technology right now and have a little bit of a problem, but we'll get it together. Okay. Looks like we've got the mics all turned on except one, and that one should be coming on in just a second. Okay. Okay, I'm having a little bit of a problem with yours, Mr. Bianchi, but we'll get you on. In the meantime, while I'm working on getting Mr. Bianchi's mic turned on, I see some of our regulars, so anyone who wants to start off and chime in, please go right ahead.
Hello.
Hey, Stephanie, go ahead. How are you?
Hi, I am good. How are you? I hope I'm glad that you're feeling better. You know,
thank you.
I want to thank you for all of your compassion that you have continually shown to the Black community, as our forefathers have also done. Even though I know I get a little overly irate when people seem to disregard the struggle of the African American in this country as if that has no bearing on the afflictions of today, because we all know it does. You know, when people who seem to have no compassion, love, or concern, you know, that even our president and government allows poisons to filter through the waters and contaminated pipes in the Black communities, or that the budget cuts being made are on health care, Black colleges, old folks SSI, Meals on Wheels, children's welfare and lunch programs, you know, with a president who his own companies are in other countries, providing those countries with employment. It just hits a nerve to me to be reminded of the house slave who has become overly dedicated to the master, as in the movie Django, a slave who is gung-ho on punishing other slaves while he hangs on to every lie of the filibuster master and refusing to acknowledge how hard African Americans have worked and studied to educate themselves to provide a better lifestyle. You know, so, no, I just don't enjoy hearing all the negativity about the black community and zero regarding the positive aspects. Because if we all focus on the negativity, we leave no room in our brain to see anything else. And then what type of message are we sending to our young people? It's not one of encouragement, nor can we focus on devising a positive outlet of plans to change our situation if we can only conjure up negativity regarding the black community. And I think that our forefathers were pretty much on the same page. They were very uplifting to our black community and giving us a lot of courage and knowledge on how to push on and to change things, you know, and to rise up. So I thank you for being like that, too. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Devin. I appreciate it. I just wanted to take a minute just to say we appreciate all of you and everything that each one of you is doing to better our situation, to help our community.
Yep.
I just want to mention before we continue, though, Ms. Piaki, I'm having a problem bringing your mic up. And on my dashboard, I see a question mark next to your phone number. I don't know what's going on. So I'd like to ask you if you would, could you hang up and dial back in, and then maybe I can bring you on? Okay. Okay, all right. So that's great. Thanks, Stephanie. You're absolutely right. I just want to make a brief comment, and then we're going to ask the others to speak. Today, I began or continued reading a very significant black history book called Incident in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs. And for any of you who have not read this book, I definitely suggest that you try to get a hold of it. It should be on Amazon.com. I got it as an audio book from Audible.com, which is under Amazon.com. And I think I also have the written version from Amazon.com, but I like to listen to audio books. And it is such a tragic story, a sad personal testimony towards the egregious disrespect and really ill treatment, harmful influences, and just terrible, terrible wrongs that the white people of the South under slavery, and some were up north as well. They had slavery up there too, but not like down south. And how our people just really, really suffered. I won't go into the horrific details tonight, but, you know, there's a saying by one of the philosophers that anyone that does not remember their history is doomed to repeat it. And the truth of the matter is that, and I'm not going to give you a history lesson because I want to hear what you all have to say, but I just want to say that, you know, the African people were brought to America to provide free labor to enrich the white settlers, particularly the English settlers, who did not want to work. Later, there were other ethnicities that came over here, like the Germans and the Poles and the Swedes and the Irish, who didn't mind working, but those original English settlers, these were the castaways of the English society. One of the reasons why many of them came over here, especially to Georgia, was because they were in prison, in what they call debtor's prison, because they would not pay their bills. And I'm not going to say why they didn't pay their bills, but one of the reasons why a lot of them starved when they came over here to America, especially to Virginia, is because they didn't want to work. And so the leaders of the colonies said, well, we have to be able to produce a crop and be able to take it back to England to justify our being able to have these colonies. So they came up with the idea of going to Africa and getting slaves from Africa and bringing the black Africans over here to do the work. Well, this attitude of using black people as the footstools for their enrichment has not left the American psyche. You know, it has not. And we have to face the fact that we can't depend on the people that enslaved us to give us prosperity and to give us the higher type of lifestyle that they have. That's not why we came over here, and that's not their purpose to think that they are going to be able to give us something that we should be trying to get without depending on them. So when we talk about our issues to get from where we are today, we do have to sometimes talk about the bad things that we're doing to ourselves. We've got a lot of books that have been written about what they did to us, that we shouldn't forget that. But more importantly, we should stop hurting our own progress by what we're doing to ourselves. So that's my little speech. And Ms. Bianca, I still see that question mark on your number. I don't know what is going on, because I definitely want to hear from you. I'm doing everything I can on my end to try to bring you up. But don't worry about it. We're going to get you. I just probably have to go to another device, and maybe I can make it work. So stay with us. Don't leave us, because I want to hear what you have to say. But in the meantime, please go ahead. The next person who would like to speak, you go ahead while I'm working on getting Ms. Bianchi's mic turned on through our device here. And you go ahead and say what you have to say. We are listening, we are wondering, we are thinking, and we are hoping. So please help us out here. So let's hear somebody else. Okay.
Hi, Salaam Alaikum. Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me?
Well, yeah, I hear you, buddy. Go ahead.
Okay. I just want to say that, you know, it's wonderful that we're here in 2017 and we can actually explore ideas of our black leaders of African American descent, our former, black people of slave descent. So exploring the ideas of their leadership, it's just I think that our ancestors would be so proud that we can actually have a radio show or a talk show or anything, that there are still some people in our race who are striving for excellence. And I think what I want to say pretty much is that the leaderships of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Martin Luther King and Booker T. Washington, what things did they have? And I was trying to think of what things did they have in common. And the thing that really stands out for the three of them is that they were striving for excellence, selves and for their people, and they loved their people. Booker T. Washington's argument was that, you know, black Americans of slave descent should try to improve themselves or empower themselves through education and industrial training and business ownership. And he felt that, you know, equal rights would come later. He believed that. And then Martin Luther King, he was very courageous man at 26 years old to stand up against white supremacy and white power structure in his country to try and using nonviolent tactics to stand up for fighting against all the injustices that were heaped on the people of survivors, on people who are of I'm not feeling too well, but of slave descent, you know, descendants of slave descent. He was so brave and courageous in standing up and striving for excellence for not just for his own people, but for all minorities, for all people. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you know, just exploring all these ideas that these leaders had. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, with his supreme wisdom and lessons, is just a little tiny man with so much power. And I think his thing was do for self, and he wanted black people to separate completely from the Caucasian or European Americans and start our own nation, our own society, have our own, you know, just rely on self-reliance. And I just want to say that the three of them, they were all, they were just excellent human beings and examples for the rest of us. And I think that we can take something from each one of them and move forward in the 21st century. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, Sister Ben, thank you. I'm still working with getting Mr. Bianchi on, and I've got an alternate for you, sir, if this, what I'm working on right now, doesn't work, I'm going to ask you to call in as a co-host, and I give you the numbers to call, and that should put you on. Matter of fact, you can try that now. If you got a pen, write this down. 319-527-6060. Call that number, and then they'll ask you for a pen. And that's 925-608-2070. I'll repeat that. 319-527-6060. And then the PIN will be 925-608-2070. 925-608-2070. And again, we'll continue while I'm trying to work with Mr. Bianchi to get him on. You're right, Sister Baina, absolutely. You know, I'm fortunate because of a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that being the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, I was imbued with his spirit as a child because I grew up in the house that he gave to my grandmother, his daughter-in-law, and his son, my grandfather, for a wedding present when they got married. And so she was just so thankful and grateful to Booker T. Washington, not just for giving her a beautiful home, but for everything that she experienced under his leadership there at Tuskegee while he was alive during her marriage to my grandfather, who lived longer than his daddy by a few years, maybe 20 years after Booker T. Washington died. No, yeah, 20 years. She and my grandfather lived together, and then he died at a young age from some illness. But the fact is that she constantly was pouring into me the spirit of Booker T. Washington, which I carry with me today. And so having that experience naturally, I'm a Booker T. Washington fan, a Booker T. Washington promoter. But because of the fact that as a young man I was looking for a living model, someone that was on the scene that I could emulate as a leader. When I became around 12 years old, I became familiar with the work of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad through the Pittsburgh Courier newspaper, where he had a column every week. And I read the column, and I was attached to the self-help and moral development program that he was promoting. And I have to tell you, you know, the publishers of the Pittsburgh Courier wouldn't allow him to put in the kind of diatribes against white people that he was known for. So we had sort of a milder version presented to us in the Pittsburgh Courier. And so that attracted me because it sounded like my great-grandfather. And then when I was 12 years old, around that same time, my father introduced me to Martin Luther King. And that was a wonderful experience because we remained associated with each other for the rest of Martin Luther King's life. And I don't know, you know, it's just, I don't know, you could call it serendipity or just chance or God's will that I happen to have a direct connection to three of these great, great leaders who I knew personally. In a sense, I knew Booker T. Washington not personally, but I knew him through his work at Tuskegee, which surrounded me, and growing up in the house of someone that did know him personally, i.e. my grandmother. And I'm just thankful that I have this spirit, and I know that as time goes by, I'll be probably more effective in promoting this spirit. So Anyway, I would like to ask you all who are listening to just go ahead, first come, first serve, just chime in. We're certainly looking forward to hearing whatever you have to say. So just anyone who wants to speak up, as we say, we just compare those leaders that I just mentioned.
All right, I look like I made it.
Thank God. You know, I am so happy. I was working with, I don't know what was going on, but I just couldn't, on the device that I was using, I couldn't bring you on. But great, well, welcome.
It wouldn't let you. I wouldn't let me dial in on the host because you're already on there.
Oh, okay, but you got in the other way? Okay.
Well, no, I had to use another phone number.
That's what I'm seeing, a different phone number. Okay, right on. Okay, well, God bless you, and thank you so much. So you're familiar with the topic that we did choose to chose to discuss, and I just made a little monologue about my relationship with these three great people. Would you like to go ahead and say something about all of them or a couple of them or one of them?
Well, you know, you talk about these different personages down through history, and I think you made mention of them. Of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, and before him there was a lady by the name of Collie House who led the ex-slave mutual pension and benefit fund. And she had over 400,000 members in her organization. And ironically, the way she communicated was by U.S. mail. That was also the way that they stopped her. But Marcus Garvey message, that the thing, that agenda that he had, he tried that in Jamaica, and it fell on deaf ears. Matter of fact, it threw rocks at him, seemingly. So he brought that agenda here to the United States, and he liked what Booker T. Washington was doing. Booker T. Washington had a self-help agenda, get education, well, skills, really. And apply those skills in areas where one could. He said to ignore discrimination. Even that should be done today, because discrimination is not illegal unless you violate somebody's civil rights. And Marcus Garvey had an idea that was only targeted to certain people. He himself said it was not for all. It was only for those. His idea wasn't anything new. You had two gentlemen way before him. One in the late 1700s had a Back to Africa movement, and you had one in the early 1800s, 1839, I believe it was, that had a Back to Africa movement. And I believe the first one was Paul Kofi, but yeah. I don't want to take up too much time on the show. So his idea was to establish trade between this country, where blacks were, and Africa, and be the recipients of those items that you was trading on the other side. And Liberia was one place that he looked at. Whereas Du Bois, his idea was to elevate yourself through academics. Du Bois and Garvey didn't get along. Garvey and Booker T got along. Booker T and Du Bois didn't get along. And actually, I think it was actually Du Bois and the organization that he was a membership that sicked the FBI on Garvey. The FBI wouldn't even pay him any attention. And that's, you have to look at that. If whites was trying to get blacks out of the country, why would they put up efforts to stop, to dwarf an effort by Garvey to do just that? Elijah Muhammad, his organization was directed at certain people. It wasn't directed at all. And he had also a similar agenda like Garvey did. Matter of fact, I think all of them was Garveyites to some aspect or another, even Malcolm X. And the Nation of Islam, amongst themselves, was doing very well. They had the largest employer of black people in the country in the 50s. They had their own means of media. They had shipping, should I say, import from down around South America, where they was bringing in goods in the form of fish, for instance. And they had other things that was going on, you know, in the Chicago area. So they were self-sufficient speakers, including farming, by the way. And then King was the individual that represented the other aspect of black society that choose to be a part of it. And they should, because they are United States citizens, deserve all the rights and privileges of being a citizen. And the concentration was in the South, where you still had some horrific things that was going on to prevent blacks from seeking their own self-determination in areas that they want, from education, being able to participate in self-suffrage and voting, businesses, and also being able to vote. When King came up north, you had preachers that didn't want to have anything to do with him. And he received a lot of pushback when he came up north, like his march there in Chicago. So between those three, maybe four, you had different opinions and agendas. Martin Delaney, going back to the early 1800s, Martin Delaney was admitted to Harvard Medical School. He was a major in the Army, and he was probably the first person to coin black nationalism. So there we are, to where we are today. Key thing is that those groups had agendas amongst themselves. Of course, they tried to entice others to join in. They still do that today amongst all groups. One try to pull one, others from over there, and others over there try to pull others from over there. They're trying to get bodies. And that's a continuation that we see today. You know, Du Bois went after Hubert Herbert Harrison, too. He was nicknamed the Black Socrates. They tried to get him. He came up during the Harlem Renaissance period. They tried to get him fired from his post office job because of his black nationalist thought. Du Bois represented part of the NAACP, which he would go on to depart from, because I think he made mention that their policy was more of a policy of dependence than, you know, self-help. Martin Luther King had a lot of NAACP influence too. But that's what that organization is about. It's still about that today. And you know, you may mention too, you may mention Mr. Moore being a pedophile. I wouldn't go that far, because he never was convicted of that. Everything that he was accused of doing with allegations and assumptions. John Conyers was accused of things too, the allegations and assumptions. Cosby's allegations and assumptions. So I wouldn't express that type of designation of people unless they've been brought to the court.
I stand corrected, and I apologize, Judge Roy Moore, for saying that about you, since you have not been convicted, and I thank you for that correction. I do sincerely thank you, Ms. Bianchi.
So, you know, Booker T. Washington's idea should still play out today with Tuskegee, a land-grant college, and I think you know of several others. I think Alcorn is one. That may be Mississippi State, I'm not sure. But the his educational, his skill, gaining skills in order to be able to provide the service that is needed in that world at that time, and also at today's world, as people talk about trade schools, which I think is very needed. I think academics is very needed also in the fields of the STEM fields, plus one other M, medicine. I think that that's a direction that people need to be more due diligent in, and to prepare your young people. School choice is another option that should be utilized. All those options should be utilized to the greatest extent. I'm sure you would think so too.
Well, I do agree. I totally agree. And I'm not going to give a monologue right now. I did in the beginning, but I do want to thank you for all of that great information that historically very, very detailed and profound information that we all need to be familiar with. I do want to say this, and then we want to ask others to contribute. The fact is that we're still moving up the ladder. I remember just a few days ago looking at a program where I believe his last name is Nelson, Stanley Nelson, is a public, he's on PBS. He does movies, documentaries, and he has one that's actually premiering in the next couple of months. But you can pre-order it so you can get the DVD in advance. Tell them we are rising in the history of black colleges and universities. And they do have a trailer so that you can get an advanced look at what the content of this program is going to be. And in this program, which he was speaking, and then he had given the people in the audience the opportunity to make comments. And the big issue, or not issue really, but the big emphasis was the value of the black college education, and those who were students of black colleges that were present, those who had graduated. And, of course, I'm an alumnus of Tuskegee. I did not graduate from Tuskegee, but having attended there for 2 years and being a past president of the class that I was in, it qualifies me, according to their policy, as being considered to be officially an alumnus. But the fact is that I grew up on that campus and am part of that history anyway. But the fact is that the people that said they valued the black colleges, most of what they said they valued, and I don't want to discredit or put down anybody or devalue what anybody said, has to do with the social and cultural aspects of being in that kind of environment. I know the 2 years that I spent as a student at Tuskegee, I pledged a fraternity there. I was president of my class. I was a member of various clubs, even worked on a student newspaper. So I was very much involved in the cultural and social aspect of the life of the students at Tuskegee. And I value that. But the question that was raised is that to what extent are the black colleges helping us to rise in terms of being able to achieve equality or parity with the majority, which won't be the majority long the way things are going, because the combined African, American, and Hispanic population in the next 20 years is probably going to equal or take over the majority. But the thing I'm saying is that are we really being prepared? I'm not talking about getting jobs. You know, I got a job with a management job with AT&T after spending a couple of years at Tuskegee, but I also had some time at the University of California, Berkeley. I don't know what the human resources people valued the most. Maybe they valued Tuskegee and Berkeley on the same basis. But the fact is, yes, we were able, coming out of these schools, to get some really great jobs, no doubt about it. But the fact is that are we really getting the most out of these schools in terms of being able to get on the top of the ladder? That's a whole different conversation. If you want to talk about that tonight, we can. But I'm just saying that we have still still a long way to go. That's my point. And so those leaders that we mentioned, including Marcus Garvey, and I didn't intentionally leave him out, and I'm not going to say that it was an oversight, but I didn't want to spread the wealth where we were talking about too many people, but he definitely needs to be in the mix when we talk about the great leaders of our people. So I'm finished with my little monologue, and I hope I didn't take up too much time. But please, if you've got any thoughts about the topic in general, anything Mr. Bianchi said or I said or Stephanie said or Sister Baina said, please go right ahead and chime in. Don't be shy. Please go ahead. Let us hear from you. Okay, I'm going to have to do a radio check. Make sure I'm still on the air then, because I'm not hearing any response. This is what we do in the business I used to be in, which is radio communications. Anytime the net gets silent, we call the communications.
Yeah, you're
on. I'm on. Okay, good. Thank you. I need to get that so I make sure that I hadn't dropped off. Okay, well, great. So would anybody like to make any contributions or any follow-up on what we've said so far? Well, I do want to share this with you. I didn't want to be monopolizing the conversation, but I do want to share something from my book. I'll take the opportunity to share something that Booker T. Washington said. This is from my book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, A Message That Would Change America, published in 2015 and still available. If you just text me at 706-399-5006. You can order the book directly from me. I'm a self-publisher, and I prefer to keep it that way because when I looked at the opportunities to have other people publish my book, I found out that only 1 out of 100 books generally gets picked up by the big publishing houses, and even some of the smaller ones charge quite a bit of money unless they see in advance that they're going to make money off of you. So I said, why don't I just do my own thing? And so I'm publishing this book. I even did the typesetting and sent it off to a printer, but I feel proud of the fact that I have been able to get my feet in the door with self-publishing. And this book, Chapter 5, Education for Living, I'll share with you unless somebody wants to speak right now.
Well, I was going to make mention, you was talking about the black colleges and universities. And you asked the question about whether or not they're doing some legitimate things. And my contention is still that the students that's coming into those institutions aren't prepared properly, whereas they can perform at the level that they would need to. And it's not really the student's fault, it's the institutions that they come from. A lot of them coming from public schools. The graduation rate and performance from about the top 5, above 50%, then you have varying graduation rate percentages all the way down to some of the lowest, about 12%. And those schools are going to be closed, a lot of them. I think you have, about 112 now, give or take a few. And you'll probably be down to about 25 in the next decade because they can't sustain. They're not attracting anyone. If you have individuals that go into those institutions that's not prepared, not only them, but any really, then it's going to be a struggle. So they should be well prepared. Better so than they are now as a whole, not all, but as a whole. And then, as we have always mentioned, those areas of business, of professions, that begging and not going fulfilled, we should target those areas. Target medicine, target computer sciences, target the engineering fields. Target those businesses areas that you don't see much activity out of African Americans in mining, earth extractions, and so on and so on. And then you, if you have graduates that have discretionary funds, then your possibility and your chances of having contributions going towards your endowments, endowments which are used to serve as a means to help fund students' tuition, more so than what they are now, along with scholarships. So those things can be implemented with more due diligence, a more better planning, and also fighting for those programs that, you know, like this administration is trying to get with school choice. Those there have some long-term benefits. Your Black Historical College should become research and development institutions where they have medical trials being accomplished, where you have research and development into new technologies, research and development into communication and space applications of communication, and so on and so on and so on. It just takes a will in a way. And we can prepare our young people so they can have those types of things. And you know, another thing, you might want to speak on the military. You know, at one time, the military, especially the Navy, was a outlet where you could learn skills and become educated and skillfully trained when you came out of the service and go right into the private sector and continue your wage and salary earning career.
Well, I'd just like to interject something since you did bring up the Navy. As I may have announced in the past, I spent 24 years in the Navy as a information systems technician, and it was a very rewarding career in many ways. In fact, my last assignment was the regional readiness officer for internet working for Europe and the Africa and the Middle East, and I traveled extensively throughout Europe and through the Middle East, and had the opportunity to help to train hundreds of people in internet working technology. And of course, that's a very stressful type of job when you're actually doing the work of an information systems technician in a military, almost wartime environment, because we, for part of that time, still had a lot of conflicts going on in that part of the world, in the Middle East, as we have today. So, you know, there's a lot of stress with that type of job, and for that reason I chose, when I retired, not to take advantage of the opportunity to stay in that field, even though I had a very, very high top secret security clearance and could have easily walked into a, you know, very, very good position. But I chose to go back to academia, which was my first love. But the point is, you're absolutely right. And I want to mention something while we're hopefully going to be hearing in a minute from some others, that all of the things that you mentioned, Tuskegee was doing those things when I was a child, growing up in Tuskegee. When Tuskegee was focusing on trying to develop people in these different areas, even in the area of medicine. Tuskegee never had a medical school, but it was one of the few colleges that was under the governance of African-American leadership that had a hospital, had its own hospital and trained doctors and nurses. As I said, they didn't have a medical school, but it was one of the few places that had a hospital with doctors coming out of institutions like Meharry and Howard, which had medical schools, could go and do their residencies. And along with the Veterans Administration of Tuskegee, which worked in collaboration with the John Andrew Hospital at Tuskegee, to train doctors. And, of course, the Tuskegee Hospital had the, as far as I know, the only infantile paralysis treatment program for African Americans in the country. I might be wrong about that, but I know theirs was at the very top of the list. And one of the things that was significant that I remember very vividly is that every single year, the National Medical Association, which was the Association of Black Physicians, because during the years of segregation, the AMA was very reluctant to admit African-American physicians to be in that association. So the black physicians had the National Medical Association, and they met every year at Tuskegee for a conference while I was a young person anyway. And they had various clinics where people that had various ailments could come in and get, for as far as I know, free treatment from specialists in their fields. They were black people that were sympathetic to them. And also you had people presenting their research in medicine that had been done. So that was a great opportunity for me to see the strength that we had in our black medical community. And, of course, we know that Tuskegee was also leading the way for many years, and to some extent maybe still today, in the field of engineering. Most all of the graduates from Tuskegee's engineering program, which was a five-year program, were able to go into very good corporate engineering jobs. There were just many things that were going on in Tuskegee that weren't necessarily popular at other black colleges. And that's one of the reasons why I'm working very hard to try to help Tuskegee, to promote Tuskegee, to be able to maintain its accreditation and maintain its status as a go-to type of university, and not just for African Americans. One of the things that I learned during my research for my book is that during the time that Booker T. Washington was president, he had Caucasians there. He had Indians from India there. He had Chinese from Chinese there. He had American Indians there. He had Africans from Africa there. You know, so the kind of diversity program that now is being almost forced into the majority universities, he was doing that kind of thing voluntarily. Now, I will admit 95% of the student population there were African Americans from around the region near where Tuskegee was. But the thing about it was that he reached out to everyone, and what he provided gave many of these students from different countries the kind of training where they were able to go back to their countries and uplift their people with the skills that they learned. And I'll close on this note, not close the show, but close my little monologue, is that in 2001, I was fortunate, I was very privileged to be the representative of the Booker T. Washington family on a C-SPAN program that was actually produced at Tuskegee. And as we were getting set up for the airing of the show, which was a live program about Booker T. Washington and about Tuskegee, I was ushered into Booker T. Washington's private study in his home. Now, I had been in the Oaks, the home of Booker T. Washington, many times as a child, as a college student, and as an adult. But I didn't go into that particular room and study. I don't know why, but I hadn't been there before. So when I went in there, I was amazed at what I saw. And what I saw was an ornate presidential type of desk, but it was a Chinese type of design. And it was large, big, large desk, like something that a university president should have, but more importantly, something like a governmental president would have. And it had a throne-like chair. Now, I wouldn't have wanted to sit there and work 8 hours with that chair because it was so, what I would say, rigid. It was made out of wood, and maybe he just had it in there. But the fact is that desk he did actually use, as far as I know. The thing is that the Chinese, a family of Chinese people gave that as a gift, had it had it crafted and shipped to America, shipped all the way to Tuskegee, and it was a thank you gift to Booker T. Washington for the training that he gave this Chinese young man and maybe other Chinese people that had gone to Tuskegee. So what I'm saying is that my position, of course, I'm prejudiced, I guess you could say, but my position is that in order to survive, a lot of these schools that aren't really doing a good job for the reason that you mentioned, because of the preparation or lack of preparation of a lot of the students that go there, they should look at other options to do the kinds of things that will make them attractive in this new age of what I would say industrial development. So that's all I'm going to say right now. Again, the mics are all open to anyone that wants to chime in. Please feel free to go ahead. Okay, I don't know. Usually we have a more robust conversation, but everybody that has dialed in, the mics are open on this end. So I don't know if you would like for me to just play a commercial while you think about something, or if you would like to speak.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Stephanie. Oh, is this Stephanie or Biden?
This is Stephanie. Assalamu alaikum.
Go ahead, Steph.
All praise be to God. Thank you. I want to thank all of the speakers tonight. I think it was really brilliant, all the things that you had to say, and all of the encouragement into our community. And I just thank you all. And I know that it's been said on the show before. It just seems like a lot of stuff that's being taught in some of these colleges. I don't want to go so far as to say it's a waste of time, but changing the curricular studies and focusing more on, like the brother said, the important things out there, things that will really take these young people somewhere. Like, I have my husband's best friend. His daughter just graduated as an engineer, and bam, she already got a job in the field. Little girl is doing real well. Now, my own granddaughter, God bless her soul, she is struggling through trying to become a scientific, forensic pathologists, which there's only five of them in the country. I won't say really struggling in a sense as in her school studies, because she stays on the dean's honor roll list. Now, she's already having a hard time getting employment in the field of science. I just hate to see my granddaughter come out of a college with owing something like a couple hundred thousand, and struggling to get a job in the field. I know that everything a person does is important, whether you work in McDonald's or whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, or something like that, but it's just, if a person has to work a place like McDonald's, don't make that permanent. Let that be temporary until you can do better, because even those type of menial jobs keep a person off the street, at least. They're not out there committing crime. But some of this stuff will you really get a job in the field? After doing all that schooling, I don't know. Maybe I should have more faith. We'll just see what's to come. But I just appreciate everything everybody has said, and I know that when I was in college, there were several students who had been in the military, and the military was paying for their schooling. And I thought that was a really good thing. They were paying pretty good, whereas the rest of us had to get student loans and so forth. But I guess a student has to be careful and choosy on the subject that they choose to go into so that they just don't get caught in the crossfire of debt and unemployment, or wind up in something that wasn't really even their field. Well, yes, you know. Thank you.
Okay,
well,
let me just say something.
Go ahead, Bonnie. You know, black people have been fighting relentlessly since the 19th and the 20th century to be a part of the American society as contributors towards a multicultural democracy, okay? Du Bois said, to live to veil, right? Langston Hughes said, I too sing America. Baldwin, he said what he said. King said what he said. I have a dream, whatever. I think that we as a people, we're caught up somewhere between being accommodationist and nationalist, or maybe not even that. I don't know. There, you know, accommodationism and nationalism, I say, in our approach towards white supremacy. Booker T. Washington, Joseph A. Jackson, Elijah Muhammad, these are classic examples of individuals whose movements, and their movements were, you know, they were rather either adjusted to prevailing systems, either by acceptance or by outright rejection. And that's to say, they offered critical challenges to the structure of injustice and inequality that we're still dealing with today in the 21st century. And I think that our people somewhere, the middle class people, we're still trying to create ourselves in a society that makes us feel insecure about our intellectual and our professional credentials. And that's to say that, you know, the so-called black bourgeoisie or middle class people, they're reluctant to accept their own people if they're too far to the black, then they don't want to I'm so tired. We're caught up in somewhere, and we're still creating ourselves, and this exasperation going on, rather than admiration of the. There's too many negative aspects of African Americans in the society. When it comes to educational training, intellectual activities, you know, it's like a regard for NASA as being in a service to the greater goal of personal advancement and precursionary reward. And the middle class seems to think that they've transcended, and then they have a tendency to I don't know what I'm trying to say. Avoid anything that. Yes.
No, I just didn't want you to push yourself too hard. I know you said you weren't feeling well, and I think we got your message, but please continue if you want
Okay. No, I think that we're still trying to create ourselves, but I think I need to stop talking now because I'm really not feeling well. But okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to say this. Going back to something that Mr. Bianca had said a few minutes ago about the lack of preparation or the inadequate preparation of many of the black students entering college. And I teach at the university, and I also was director of an admissions program at Tuskegee a number of years ago. And, yes, truly, many of our students, it just didn't start recently. It goes back a very long ways because it was so 50 years ago that I had this position at Tuskegee, and we had to set up a tutorial program. We were one of the earlier programs, which is called Learning Support now in some areas, to be able to remediate the students that did come into college that were not fully prepared for college work. But one of the experiences that I had about 3 years ago was, and I may have mentioned this before on this program, but a young African-American female came to me. She was a freshman, and she had received a poor grade on the first draft of an essay that she was required to do. And one of the things that I do in addition to teaching American history and world history is also teach research skills and academic writing, and I do tutoring in those fields and actually have a class in American history. But she came to me, and I looked at her work that she had turned in, for which she had gotten a poor grade, and I started going through the draft line by line and pointing out the errors either in construction or grammar or spelling or the logic, et cetera. And in each line, it was something that needed to be fixed. And as I got through the paper, I don't even think I got to the second page, and she almost broke down and started crying. And she says, I can't do this. And I said, what do you mean? I said, I'm showing you how to do it, because when I showed her what was wrong, I showed her how to fix it. And I said, I'm helping you. I'm showing you how to get this paper improved. She said, I don't mean that. She says, I can't do college. It's too hard. And that really hurt me. You know, it really hurt me that she hadn't even finished the first year and already she was ready to give up because she knew that she was not prepared. And the question that I have is, what's being done at the secondary school level to fix this problem, since obviously that's where it needs to be fixed? Does anyone have any comments about that? Okay, I see we've had some people that have dropped off, I think. And so I guess we're getting towards the end. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to play something that I'd like for our listeners to hear. This is actually a message from the minister of the Nation of Islam, the assistant minister to Mr. Louis Farrakhan, who's actually the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I'm reading it, but this is something that he actually said in a speech not long ago, well, maybe about 10 years ago, frankly. But I'd like to share it with you.
I am sharing with you now an article that was published in a book entitled Booker T. Washington, A Re-Examination, which was compiled by Mr. Lee H. Walker and edited by Diane Carroll Bast and S.T. Karnick. The date of publication is June 2008. And the title of the article is Up, You Mighty Nation, The author is student minister of the Nation of Islam under Minister Louis Farrakhan. Ismail Muhammad, the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the National Assistant to the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And I quote, "I am grateful for the opportunity to examine the work and contributions of such a great man, not just an American, but a great human being, a great black man, who in his blood had both races, black and white. He was able to offer a viable alternative and a solution, not just for America, but also for the problem that his own black community faced in the early 20th century. Our dear theologian, scholar, and freedom fighter, Dr. Hysel B. Taylor, said all of the right things and made the right points. And in truth, all I can say is amen and bear witness to the truth. And perhaps strengthen us to honor the legacy of such a great man by doing as Dr. Hysel B. Taylor proposed, and that is that we have to put aside our labels. We cannot continue to be defined by the labels that have been placed on us that give to each of us a value, but not our true value. I am neither Baptist nor Presbyterian. I am not Catholic. I am not Jewish. I am not conservative. I am not liberal. I am a human being, a child of God. I am not American. I am not African. You cannot define me by geography or territory. I am a child of God. We are indeed fulfilling what is written in the scriptures. We are a lost people. I am representing the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. What Booker T. Washington gave, and for which his critics labeled him an accommodationalist, presented something that would have brought black people further along than where we find ourselves today. Elijah Muhammad advocated that principle of self-reliance, of a people doing something for themselves. Booker T. Washington expressed and manifested a spiritual principle that is found in the Quran, where Allah says he will never change the condition of a people until that people change their own condition. As a people, we cannot win the respect of others until we show that respect for ourselves. This is why Booker T. Washington won the respect of the white conservatives in the South, and they were willing to back him up, and did back him up with dollars and money to invest in the building of our own institutions. White folks had already told black folks that they were free, but they did not give us the tools by which we could exercise that freedom. However, we had the right to exercise that self-determination, which earned the respect of whites in the South during the time of Booker T. Washington, and earned the respect of the president during the time that he was invited to the White House. It is this principle, which Dr. Taylor echoed to us, that is sorely missing in our community. That is why Elijah Muhammad worked 44 years to instill in us as a people self-love, self-respect, and for us not to be a Lazarus at the gate of the rich man begging for crumbs that fall from his table. For you don't see the birds lining up in unemployment lines, and you don't see among God's creatures any other creature trying to take the food that is out there for all of the creatures to feed from. The birds are not asking the bees for their honey, and you don't find the lions trying to take what has been given to the birds to eat. How foolish we look, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, as a people begging another people to feed and clothe us, to shelter us. Desegregation has done more harm to us as a people than our effort to integrate and win the hearts of those that oppressed us after they had already given to us our freedom. Self-love and self-respect is the first principle of human nature, and when we show that love and self-respect one to another in the black community, then whites or Chinese or Asians or any other people on this planet will respect black people because we are showing that respect and that love for one another. Dr. Taylor is absolutely correct. The day of protesting and demanding and asking other people to do for us what we can and should and must do for ourselves, those days are over. I don't mind what the conservative whites are doing today. I don't mind that voting rights will come up for review, even though so many of my people paid a tremendous price for us to have that right. I want you to be careful with that statement. Don't take it out of context. The point is, I don't mind them taking back all that they have given to black folks, because if we have failed to take advantage of that as a free people, then let the winds blow on these dry bones that are in a valley, and let these bones come together so they can stand up and take their rightful place in the world. We should not be beggars today when God has given us so much. That was the philosophy of Elijah Muhammad, and perhaps he would have been embraced and accepted more by whites in this nation if he hadn't called them devils. But the only reason why he called them devils was to show black people that those who are opposing you are in the character of a devil. A devil is an opponent of what is right and what is good. So he didn't mean to hurt black people or to muddy them. Many whites came out to acknowledge and praise the work of Elijah Muhammad and wish that his work were more alive today because it is so needed in the black community. As a result of the civil rights movement, we achieved the desegregation of the South and won the right to vote, to drink at white folks' water fountains, to ride in the same bus, and to eat in their restaurants. We won all of that. But we lost, because we lost our value and our pride as a people, because we have nothing to show and nothing to speak for ourselves. So a whole generation out there is lost and is now in many traps that have been laid for them. They are filling up the prisons and they've become disinterested in school. So there's a 70% dropout rate. Why? Because our children have lost their values and they can't find themselves anymore, because the effort to assimilate into America has caused us to lose our own identity. There's nothing wrong with trying to win certain rights, but my God, if you don't come to the table knowing who you are as a child of God and your place at the table, how can we be respected and honored as an equal member? We are not American, not by definition, because to be an American is to be, one, a member not belonging to the Aboriginal people. So even in the Constitution, we have to go back and look at the meaning of these words. Otherwise, we are not speaking in the proper terms, and therefore anything that we advance in the people will not go too far, because we are not defining ourselves in a modern context. We are not.
Well, we are going to end our show now. I just wanted to share that with you. And perhaps we'll continue some of this type of discussion in the future. But I just wanted to give everybody an opportunity to, as we begin the new year, and actually it's not just a new year, but I think it's a new era, because I think what we have seen, I'll be honest and tell you that I'm not a Trump hater.
Can I just say something before we go off the air? Can I just say something quickly?
Can I finish my statement, Mrs. Bainer?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that we need to have more discussions about where we need to go and what we need to do. I think we have to be honest and say that there's a lot of work that's still undone. As the minister said, we haven't really fulfilled the hopes and the aspirations that pushed us to the battle lines during the civil rights movement. We got so many things legislated that we did not take advantage of. And so now we have to start looking at strategies of how that we can grab a hold of the hook, so to speak, so we can get pulled up by our own strength and those who want to help us out. So, Sister Bain, I'm going to give you a minute. I just got the 60-second warning because actually thinking that we wouldn't have this kind of show tonight, I only set it up for an hour and a half, and the time is up. So go right ahead.
I just want to say that I think we're still where when Carter G. Woodson wrote his book, The Miseducation of the Negro, because we're still educating our people in the system, which the system teaches the demises that we're non-entities. We're still being taught that we're inferior. We're still teaching our children that their face is terse because they're black, and this is killing their aspirations and making them feel hopeless, and reducing them to what he said is the state of being vagabonds and criminals. And that's where we are, and we're in the 21st century. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, well, thank you. We've run out of time. We want to thank everybody that joined us tonight on our panel, all of our regular panelists, and we thank all of you who have tuned in via the Internet to listen to this program and to give us an uplifting spirit as we close out. We're going to play what is known as the Black National Anthem or an African-American National Anthem, I guess you would say today. This is just the music, but some of you may be able to say the words in your own mind.